I think the weather today is appropriate for the topic that we're considering. This is the kind of weather that chills you to the bone. If you've been out shoveling snow, it's not a lot of fun. At least not for me. And this is a subject that is not a lot of fun. But it's there. It's in Mark. We're working through the Gospel of Mark. I think that's one of the values of an expository approach to the Bible. You don't get to pick and choose. It just kind of has a way of showing up. Then you need to try and wrap your mind and your life around it. So, today, not the last word on the topic of divorce, but hopefully a helpful first word. Do you remember when we rarely talked about divorce? I do. Growing up in Winnipeg, I don't even think the word was in our vocabulary. I don't remember any of my friends in school coming from homes where there had been a divorce. I mean, it just wasn't something you talked about. It wasn't something that you heard about. Boy, let me tell you, my kids' school experience was totally different from mine. They all know lots and lots and lots of families where divorce was part of the equation. How the world has changed. I've kept in touch with a handful of my friends from college. One of the fellas in particular recently sent me an email to tell me that after 30-some years of marriage, he and his wife are splitting up. Actually, he's leaving his wife. They've been in our home. We have been in their home. We have shared good times together. And I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. So this set off a series of emails, and we actually exchanged some sharp words with one another about this whole topic. But my friend is adamant that he has found another person with whom he has entered into a relationship, and he finds their relationship to be so much more authentic. That's the word that he likes to use. So much more authentic than any relationship that he has ever had with his wife. I don't think any of my words, at least so far, have put even a dint into the direction that he is taking. My friends. Been reading an amazing book by R.A. Dickey, who's a pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays. He has that famous knuckleball. Don Falk can tell you all about it. He's written a book called Wherever I Wind Up. Just from the standpoint of human interest, it is a great read. I am really enjoying it. But part of what he describes is how as a young 8-year-old boy, his mom and dad split up. They divorced. And how profoundly, how deeply it affected his life. And R.A. Dickey has gone through some amazing highs and some amazing lows. And many of his lows can be attributed in some shape or form to the experience that he had in his family of origin. He is a broken man. He's a Christian man, too. And so he has real hope, and he has God confidence. Wherever I wind up, I would commend it to you as a hopeful read. As many of you know, divorce is part of my journey. It's a painful topic. I just assumed one of the elders come to me and say, you know what, Terry, why don't you just let me preach on this instead? But it's my assignment, so I get it. I can still remember the evening when my first wife told me that she was leaving. It was the saddest day in my life. There was nothing that I could say or do that would encourage her to change her mind. I still remember the day that she drove off and headed back to her home province of Manitoba. So sad. I suffered. My children suffered. Nobody suffers more than the children. I say to adults who are going through divorce, who have young children, you know what? Adults somehow or other find a way to muddle through their problems. And it's true. But children, not so much. So when I talk about this subject, it's not something that I have been only fascinated with from an academic standpoint. It's something that has been part of my journey. A friend that I've known for many, many years, who knew me both before, during, and after, said to me on one occasion, Terry, you're a different guy after this divorce. And she said, you know, I kind of like the new Terry. Boy. Well, what does Jesus have to say to modern-day disciples about divorce? We want to consider some of that. If you're here today and you're hoping to get all of your questions about all things divorce, I'm sure I will disappoint you today. I'm going to do my best to focus on Mark's presentation. There are other gospel writers who sometimes take a slightly different approach to the topic. I will reference Matthew a little bit where necessary, but there will be unanswered questions, and we will have to muddle through those together perhaps at a future date. Well, in Mark chapter 10, Jesus deals with a hot topic. The first thing that Mark tells us, actually, let's read the passage, beginning in Mark chapter 10, verses 1 through 12. Let's get it all in front of us. I'm reading from the NIV. Jesus then left that place and went into the region of Judea and across the Jordan. Again, crowds of people came to him, and as was his custom, he taught them. Some Pharisees came and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" "What did Moses command you?" he replied. They said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away." "It was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law," Jesus replied. "But at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." When they were in the house again, the disciples asked Jesus about this. He answered, "Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery." Wow. Them's are words that would go over like a lead balloon here in the 21st century. Mark begins with a travel note. He describes the early stages of Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. He was in Capernaum, and now the crew heads south. This is significant because Jesus knows where he's going. He's heading ultimately to Jerusalem. You'll notice that his travel route sort of zigzags. It heads over to the Transjordan side of Palestine, and then it crosses back over through Jericho, and then over to the capital of Judea. Jesus knows what's waiting for him in Jerusalem. He has work to do, cross work. He knows that. He's not stopping. He's heading south. Why? It's because he's determined. He's committed to doing the things that God has asked him to do. And one of the greatest assignments that he's ever been given is waiting for him in Jerusalem. So off he goes. But on the way, of course, he encounters some people who raise a controversial topic with him, and today we want to consider how he engaged with them. As is so often the case, Jesus is our example of how to engage with others. He is our example of how to engage with others even over difficult subjects. So in verses 2 through 4, first point, when asked about his opinion about divorce and related matters, Jesus inquires as to theirs. He's such a good conversationalist. The thing I like about Jesus is he never hogs the mic. Every once in a while I meet somebody, and after my interaction with them, I'll come home steaming, and I'll complain to my wife, and I'll say, "They are such lousy conversationalists. They never gave me the mic." Good conversation involves sharing the mic. Good conversation involves back and forth. Jesus was so good at that. The Pharisees come, and they raise a question. It's a loaded question. It's kind of one of those questions, "So have you stopped beating your wife yet?" It's a question that's loaded with assumptions, and he's aware of it, and so he slows the conversation down by asking them for their opinion on the subject of divorce. In verse 2, the question is raised, and as I understand the question, although it looks on the surface like they simply want to know, "Jesus, do you believe in divorce?" they actually want to know about his view on another related subject, and that is the ground of divorce. We know that for two reasons. One, if we go to the parallel passage in Matthew, Matthew 19:13, one of the things we discover is that Mark is the master of summarization. You would expect that from Mark, wouldn't you? Mark only has 16 chapters. Matthew has 28. And so we go to Matthew, same situation, similar question, same question really, and you'll notice at the end of the question that something is added. The Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? What's that about?" Well, that has to do with a new approach to divorce that is becoming extremely popular in Palestine in the first century. This was an innovation that was introduced by the famous Rabbi Hillel. We'll talk about that in just a moment. So I take it that the Pharisees were asking Jesus not simply for his opinion on divorce. They knew the answer to the question. Every Jew knew the answer to the question, is there such a thing as divorce? Is there any provision in the Bible for divorce? They knew Jesus' answer to that question, and so they were fishing around for his response to something else. And they were hoping to trip him up. You ever feel that way? Somebody comes to you with a question, and you get the sneaking suspicion that they're looking for more than just information. They're looking for something that maybe you'll hang yourself with. And they were interested to see if they could somehow entice Jesus to compromise himself either politically or theologically. Well, how would that work? Well, you recall that Jesus had a waymaker, a fellow by the name of John the Baptist. He had recently fallen on very hard times. Do you remember what happened to John the Baptist? Whew, lost his head. Remember why he lost his head? It's because he had the audacity to speak out against the marriage of the king. And he complained because the king had divorced his wife and had married his brother's wife. And of course, before that could happen, his new wife had also to divorce her husband in order to be able to marry the king. And John the Baptist had the audacity to go public with his convictions about the impropriety of this, and it cost him his head. Well, just think, if the Pharisees could somehow lure Jesus into making some kind of a similar statement, well, maybe Herod would do the dirty work on Jesus that they'd hoped he would do. And then also theologically, perhaps, if they could entice him to say something that was just kooky, because religious leaders do that sometimes. They just say kooky things, and it hurts their cause. So they're hopeful that maybe they could catch Jesus on one of those two. Something about their question doesn't smell right. Can imagine if you went for a loan to a bank and you've just teed everything up with the loans officer, you've signed all the documents, and then you say, now just a moment, before we end this interview, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about some of the ways in which I could maybe default on this loan without any penalty. Can you give me any help with that? That wouldn't quite smell like the right question, would it? Or suppose a young physician has just been, given his license to practice in the province of Alberta. And the very next appointment that he has is with a seasoned practitioner. Oh, by the way, he's taken the Hippocratic Oath. Not that long ago, I think they still took the Hippocratic Oath, which essentially bound by oath a physician to be ethical in his practice of medicine. Well, let's suppose he now goes to see a more seasoned physician to see if he can explain to him sort of the rules of the road for navigating your way through some of the loopholes in the healthcare system, getting away with things that maybe you ought not to get away with. It just doesn't smell like the right question. This doesn't smell like the right question either. Why would these religious leaders, people who were committed to the will of God, the preservation of all things holy, one of which was marriage, why is it that they would be looking for information about how do we get through the exit on marriage unscathed? And so Jesus picks up on that. So, verse 2, that's the question about divorce, about the grounds of divorce. The question then we're saying was about no-fault divorce. We call it no-fault divorce. I don't know that they use that expression. In Matthew, they use the expression for any and every reason. Do you realize that it wasn't until about 1986 here in Canada, when the Divorce Act was changed by the government of Canada, that you actually had to have grounds for divorce? You had to prove that your spouse had either been unfaithful or that cruelty had been involved in the relationship. But in 1986, the law was changed, and it's now called no-fault divorce. And that's the era in which you and I live. And no-fault divorce simply means nobody has to prove fault. Nobody has to show that anybody did anything wrong. If you want a divorce and you can pay for the legal services, you get a divorce. It's no-fault divorce. And it really sucks. And they basically came to Jesus to ask him for an opinion about a method of divorce that was really starting to take off. And of course, he didn't think much of it at all. Divorce was universally accepted amongst the Jews. They understood that there was some provision, that there was limited provision in the Old Testament for divorce under limited circumstances. So that was never a question of debate. The question of debate had to do with what are the circumstances around what constitutes a valid divorce. And if there was a valid divorce, then there could be a valid remarriage. The grounds were debated, and there were two rabbinic schools. The two most popular schools were the school of Shammai, and you can read what they had to say about the grounds for divorce. And the other school was the school of Hillel. Hillel died in about AD 10, so his life and the life of Jesus would have overlapped slightly. He has been credited, although I don't know why you'd want to get credit for it, but he has been credited with this new style of divorce, which was taking off in first century Palestine and was by far and away, and you can appreciate why. Can you believe that? The rabbi Hillel says even if she spoils his dish, and even if he found somebody else prettier than she, wow, not very hard to get a divorce under those circumstances. And so you had these two schools of thought. The more liberal school, Hillel, was by far and away the most popular. Jesus is asked to render an opinion. Verses 3 through 4. He passes the mic back over to the Pharisees. What do you guys think? I'll be happy to tell you what I think, but I'd like to hear first from you. What do you have to say? Well, being the biblically astute people that they are, they went right to Deuteronomy 24, which was one of the most popular passages to describe the limited basis for divorce under the Old Covenant. And they honestly said that it's true Moses never commanded divorce, but he did make permission for it. He reluctantly permitted it. And we'll talk about that more in just a moment. The point is that in the first century, divorce was relatively easy to obtain. Just as today, divorce is relatively easy to obtain. And it's not surprising that so many people resort to that option when there's trouble, when there are problems, when a nicer Mr. Right shows up, when a prettier girl comes along who has a big, thick bank account. You can understand why people are drawn into exit mode in their marriage. Okay, so when asked about his opinion, he inquires as to theirs. Verses 5 through 9. Now, I must admit, this is the part of the passage that I like. There is some light at the end of the tunnel. This is the part of the passage where Jesus says, you know, for now, I don't really want to talk about divorce. That's a kind of depressing subject. I'd rather talk about marriage. I'd rather talk about the ideal. Let's consider for a moment the design that God had for marriage. Boys, let's go back to the beginning. You wanted to go back to Moses. We can even go further back than that. Let's go all the way back to Genesis chapter 2. And so he does. And that's when Jesus begins to speak frankly about the problem by putting it up against the backdrop of God's ideal. In verse 5, the first thing he tells them is, you know what, gentlemen, whatever else divorce is, oh yes, it may be a family problem, it may be a social problem, there may be a lot of lenses through which you can take a look at divorce, but at the end of the day, more fundamental than anything else, it is a problem of the heart. It is a problem of the attitude. It capitalizes on this hankering that all of us humans experience far too often, this attitude that we have, that we throw up resistance to the will and the way of God. I don't know if that ever happens to you. It happens to me. I think it happens to you as well. There are times when you just feel like, come on, God, really? Or, can you just make an exception in my case? Do we really have to go down that road? Human resistance to God's will regarding relationships and marriage, Jesus said, was the reason why this law was put into the Pentateuch. That's why God thought it was important to put some boundaries on the thing. Because we all know what happens when there isn't a good boundary around something. People will just go on and on and on. I imagine divorce existed before this legislation in Deuteronomy 24 existed, but God wanted to curtail it. He wanted to contain it. I think of sometimes when you're driving through the mountains and you're going down a very steep hill, and then off on one side, you see this really steep lane. You ever notice those lanes? And the kids all want to know, wow, what is that? Hate to shovel that driveway. Of course, that's a runaway lane. It's there so that if, as a driver, you ever find yourself in a bad situation, hopefully it'll keep the bad situation from getting a whole lot more worse. And in a sense, this legislation in Deuteronomy, and there are other passages in the Old Testament that talk about divorce and grounds for divorce as well, But it's kind of God's way of containing things. It's God's way of trying in some way to ensure that it doesn't get a whole lot worse. Does that make sense? A heart issue. It's right here. This is where it starts. And ultimately, this is where it gets solved too. Right here, the heart. In verses 6 through 9, Jesus begins to talk about God's design for marriage. And I love this. This is the part that I really like about weddings. I like talking about Genesis 2. I think I'll always talk from Genesis 2 from now on when I do weddings. So some of you hurry up and do what you need to do so we'll have another wedding here at the chapel. But Jesus says in verse 6 that when God made the human family and he created human beings, he decided that he wanted to have two modes. Humanity, the species we call Homo sapien, they have two modes. There is a male mode and there is a female mode. And of course the French say, vive la différence. Isn't it great that it's not just all guys running the world? It's not just all women running the world, but there are these two genders, boys and girls, men and women. As a young boy, I enjoyed the existence of both men and women, males and females. I just thought the world was a whole lot better because of it. Nobody had to teach me as a guy to show and to be interested in the other gender, and I assume that it's the other way around as well. So verse 6, he reminds us that God created two genders. In verses 7 through 8, he talks about this amazing thing that happens between the genders. Or at least he implies it. There's this dynamic, you may have noticed. You have teenagers, you will know this all too well. And hopefully us older folk as well. There's this amazing dynamic. You might think of it as couple chemistry. It's just different. Have you ever been in a room, just guys, and one girl walks into the room? Guys, I hate to blow your cover, but it changes everything. The posture, you know, the posture gets a little better. The abdomen goes in. It's just different. Ladies have an effect on guys. Guys have an effect on ladies. There's this couple chemistry. And in Genesis chapter 2, we discover that it's so powerful, the draw. I hope you're not uncomfortable, anybody. We're just talking about stuff that's been around like for a long, long time. This is just the birds and the bees stuff, right? There is this incredible draw between men and women. You remember when you were first drawn to your spouse? There is this incredible draw, and it's so powerful that it ends up in leaving. Genesis 2:24, for this cause, a man shall leave gladly. He shall leave his father and his mother. And it doesn't stop there. There's leaving. He leaves his family of origin in order to start another family. And you know what? Nobody really has to teach us to do this. I mean, yeah, there are skills that we need, and there's intelligence that we need, there's wisdom we need, but there's just something so primal about this. We just do it instinctively. There's leaving. And then there's cleaving, or there's coupling. Literally, the man and the woman couple physically, intimacy. There's emotional bonding, spiritual bonding. It's all very mysterious how it happens. But it's so deep. And you don't realize sometimes how deep it is until there's a temporary separation between the spouses, or God forbid, a more permanent separation through either divorce or death. Boy, death messes with people. I know that just from some of my visiting with those of you who are widows or widowers. This really messes because there's been this close, intense bonding that has happened, and now something has come along and just torn it asunder, and it's painful, it's awful. It happens. So there's leaving. This dynamic of couple chemistry leads to leaving. There's coupling, and then there's a unit. And it's really interesting how the Bible talks about this, you know, one flesh. It's a pair. It's like there's two and yet it's a pair, right? It's like a pair of shoes. You got a left and you got a right. They're similar, but they're not identical, but they make one pair. Or a scissors. You say, get me a pair of scissors. And they hand you this thing that's got two parts. They're similar. They're not quite identical. And they're a pair. They're bonded. There's a unit. That's the way God made it. That's the way God wants it to be. There's leaving, there's coupling, there's a unit. And then in verse 9, Jesus says these famous words that what God has joined together, let no one separate. This bonding It's for how long? What's the intention? It's for life. It's for keeps. That's what you do when you exchange your wedding vows. How long is this for? The preacher should maybe say this, because sometimes people forget. How long is this going to be for? This is for keeps, right? This is for life. This is till death do us part. That's the design. Now, the passage has sometimes been misunderstood. This is a command. It is a command that can be disobeyed. Sometimes people have said, well, you know, if God has joined it together, nobody could ever separate it. No, that's not the point. The point is, thou shalt not separate what God has joined together. You can dismantle it. You can destroy this, but you must not. Thou shalt not. You learn a lot about a person's religion when you find out what are the thou shalt nots in your religion. There are some. It's not all thou shalt not, but there are prohibitions. There are things that are forbidden. You don't really understand a person's religion until you understand what some of their list of forbidden things are. And this is one of them. Don't mess with marriage. Hebrews, there's a great passage that's worth studying. Let marriage, Hebrews 13, let marriage be held in honor of all. Remember that passage? Let marriage be held in honor of all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. Why? Now comes the threat. For fornicators and adulterers, the pastor will judge. No, that's not what it says. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Don't mess with the concept of marriage. Don't mess with somebody else's marriage. Don't let them mess with your marriage. And don't you do anything that would make what is supposed to be inviolable, that it would break it. It's holy. It's sacred. It's to be revered. Blessed is the wife whose husband holds their marriage bond sacred. And blessed is the husband whose wife holds their marriage bond sacred. But Jesus did say there was a problem, and it had to do with the heart. There is just something about us as human beings. We have a way of balking at God's will and God's way. God declares, God reveals the way he wants it to be. And then pretty soon we're there with a silly, indifferent look on our face saying, whoa, what do you mean? A man and a woman. Why not two guys? Why not two gals? And that's when we remind them that in the beginning, God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Ernie. But we do challenge God's design, don't we? What do you mean? Whoa. We say, whoa, what do you mean? One man and one woman. Why can't I just, you know, if one wife is good, why not a couple? That was a problem in Old Testament times, and it continues to be a problem today, even right here in Canada. Or we say, whoa, what do you mean? Leave first, then cleave. Why can't we have a little cleaving before we do any leaving? You know, just sort of a trial run. Make sure it'll work out. Mm-mm. We balk. Those are some of the ways that we balk at the wisdom of God's design. Well, then in verses 10 through 12, Jesus comes back to topic. He always does that, doesn't he? You think, oh, good, we're off the hook. He's just going to leave this. But he comes back in verses 10 through 12. He had been asked for his opinion on the practice of no-fault divorce. What's his answer? Well, verse 10, the first thing we see is that the disciples are really struggling with all of this. And if Jesus' followers struggled with the issue of divorce and remarriage back then, do you think they might still struggle with this subject today? I suspect they might. The disciples, they're not sure about some of this. And so when they get Jesus aside in the house, they have questions for him and they ask them. And this is where he makes this, wow, shocking announcement. People, Pharisees, who undoubtedly favored the Hillel school of thought, divorce made easy, 101. This is what Jesus says. Anyone who divorces his wife, and we could add, for any and every reason, and marries another woman, commits adultery against her. All divorces that are invalid, when a remarriage happens, results in adultery. No exceptions. And he says it's the same the other way around. If a woman divorces her husband on invalid grounds and remarries, there is adultery. That is the problem with no-fault divorce, and that is the world that you and I live in. Those are the encouragements and the enticements that we are surrounded by. And it's tough. The next generation will have it a lot harder than my generation did. My generation didn't have it as hard as my parents' generation. and it shows no signs of letting up. It is sad when it happens. So sad. The fallout is staggering on family and friends. When someone divorces, it not only touches them, it touches all of their family circle. All of a sudden it gets awkward. You don't know what to say. It's difficult. But there is no one who suffers more than the children of divorce. It's so sad. That is why I honor couples whose marriage is difficult, the road is rocky, and they say, you know what, for now, the best that we can do is stay together for the kids. I honor that. It'd be nice if they could get to a point through counseling, through help, where it's more than just that. But if that's the best you can do right now, God bless you. Your kids will rise up and call you blessed. Even the rabbis admitted that heaven shed a tear every time a marriage ended in divorce. I imagine he's got a pretty big container to hold his tears. I would like to give you the best advice I think I can on divorce-proofing your marriage. You might want to write this down. Not much of what I say is maybe worth writing down, but you might just want to record this one. Save it for yourself. Pass it on to posterity. It goes something like this, and it's really simple. Let your spouse teach you how best to love you. It'd be really cool if guys, this would be real headship in action. Guys, in the not too distant future, why don't you take your wife's hand, snuggle up close to her, look her in the eye and say, honey, you really matter to me. Our relationship really matters to me. I want this thing to go on and on and on. Would you please teach me how best to love you? Because I don't know. I'm not really good at this. Don't ask your wife to do the same to you. But maybe, just maybe, if she senses that you're earnest about it and that you're sincere about it, in the not too distant future, she'll want to snuggle up to you and hold your hand and look you in the eye and say, John, I really appreciate the effort that you have been making in our marriage. Thank you so much for letting me teach you how to love me. I'd like you to do the same thing for me. Would you please teach me, John, how I can best love you? And I have a sneaking suspicion that if couples here at Balmoral really excelled in that, and if couples in Rosedale, the community where I live, and Red Deer, the city in which I live, and Central Alberta, and it could go on and on, like, wow, I think even pagans could do this. And along the way, they might find out that they need help from above. But if we were all of this mind, please, would you help me to be to you what you need? Because I don't know. But you could tell me. The trust, the depth, the intimacy, the strength in your life, in your marriage, in your family, in our community. Because communities where divorce runs rampant are weak communities. Rosedale could be so much better, so much stronger, if people lived this way in relation to one another. Sorry I didn't answer all your questions today about divorce. I hope you have questions. I hope you'll write them down. I hope you'll send them to the elders. There's probably a lot more that we need to say to the church about this. And part of what would help us is if we knew some of the concerns that you had. And by the way, I haven't had all my questions answered either. So we're in good company here. Let's pray. Oh, Jesus, lover of our souls, help us to be the people that you want us to be. Help us to be the men and the women, the husbands and the wives, the families that you want us to be. Thank you for this design for marriage. It's so wise. It is so good. We love your design. But we also confess that there is something awry with our hearts. Please forgive us. And please help us. Please empower us. Please strengthen us. Help us to rise above our depravity. To rise above our selfishness. To take our lead from Christ, who is the perfect head of his bride, who sacrifices himself for the good of others. Help us to be a people like that. And Lord, it's already been mentioned today that even in our community here at Balmoral, we continue to have hurts. Marriages continue to struggle. I suppose it will always be that way until Christ returns. But I pray that you would put within all of our hearts a humility that is open to forgiving as well as being forgiven. A humility that is open to the possibility of reconciliation. Father, empower those of us right now who are in estranged places with those that we love to have the grace that we need to make ourselves available for reconciliation. We pray through Christ.